The Recollections of N. Balaram Reddy, Part 3. Entering upon the third installment of Sri N. Balaram Reddy's Recollections, we are sad to announce the news of his sudden passing away on 11th of May in Bangalore. Sri V.S. Ramanan, the president of Sri Ramanashramam, informed us that for 2 months prior to his death, Sri Reddy was saying that he did not feel well and had already lived long enough, being in his 88th year. Sri Reddy's relatives came to the Ramanashramam and took him to Bangalore on 24th of April. There he underwent many medical tests, and on 10th of May, a doctor reviewed all the results and said that Mr. Reddy was quite fit and could easily live for 4 more years. On 11th of May, the very next day, Balaram Reddy was absorbed into his master, Sri Ramana Maharshi. When I had observed Bhagawan closely for some time, I discovered that he would never openly say that he was our guru and we were his disciples. In fact, he would sometimes say things that sounded contrary to this. But for us close devotees, there was never a doubt that he was our guru. He loved us like a mother, protected us like a father, guided us like a teacher, and moved with us like a friend. We constantly felt his guidance and grace. What do we read in the annals of the spiritual history of India about a sage like Bhagawan, living in one place for 54 years, making himself available at all times and embodying such divine qualities? We would sit in the hall and meditate with our eyes closed, or just rest our vision on his form, which we believed to be the form of God. He would teach us orally, or in silence, or again by deed, sometimes in subtle ways, and at other times directly. When I initially came to Tiruvannamalai and was living in town, I would come to the ashram very early in the morning. When the attendant first opened the doors of the hall, I would be waiting there. His opening of the door meant that Bhagawan had risen and was about to come out. Before Bhagawan had a chance to come out, I would walk into the hall and find him on the sofa, preparing to leave. He would often cover himself with a shawl at night, and when I would see him removing his shawl, I would take it from him and fold it. He was kind enough to allow me this little service. In those days, I was coming to the hall and sitting before Bhagawan in both the mornings and afternoons. During the late afternoons, larger crowds were coming into the hall for darshan and causing some disturbance. I then discovered that I could meditate in my room with less distraction in the afternoons, and consequently began omitting my afternoon visits to the ashram. One afternoon, G.V. Subramaya arrived at the ashram and, not seeing me in the hall, inquired from Bhagawan where I was. The next morning, when I was folding Bhagawan's shawl, he mentioned about what G.V. Subramaya had asked him on the previous day. By this comment, I could understand that Bhagawan wanted me to resume coming to the hall in the afternoons, though he did not say so explicitly. In spite of this, I still remained in my room that afternoon. The next morning, when I entered the hall and went over to Bhagawan to take his shawl and fold it, he did not give it to me. He quietly folded it himself. I then realized Bhagawan was admonishing me in this way. After this, I saw my error and resumed the afternoon visits to the ashram. From this, I realized that Bhagawan wanted us to benefit from his company. But how could he say it openly? In the first year of my settling in Tiruvannamalai, I remember one afternoon I was sitting in the hall and Bhagawan was explaining to me some particular point on a spiritual matter. During the discussion, he asked me to go to one of the two almirahs that were up against the west wall, open it and bring him a certain book. I searched for the book but was unable to find it. I returned to Bhagawan and informed him of my failure to locate the book and then again sat down against the south wall facing him. Presently, I saw Bhagwan alight from his couch, slowly and majestically walk over to the almirah, open it, and immediately pull out the book he asked me to find. He closed the almirah, and to my surprise, instead of walking back to the couch, he came and sat on the floor right next to me, on my left. He opened the book to the page he wanted me to read and, holding it in his right hand, held the open book before my face and asked me to read the particular passage. Attendants of Bhagwan had earlier told me that Bhagwan's body was like a furnace. Only then, when he sat so close to me, could I understand what they meant. I felt like there was an electric dynamo of spiritual power emanating from his body. I was thrilled to the core of my being. I believe the most unique characteristic of Bhagwan was the power of his presence. Much of what he taught had already been transmitted to the masses down through the ages. In Bhagwan, we found a being that was surcharged with the reality to such an extent that coming into his presence would effect a dramatic change in us. The divine power of his presence was something remarkable, entirely outstanding in this century. But why just this century? It must be so for many centuries. I always felt there was something tangibly distinct in Bhagwan's hall. When we walked into it and sat down, we immediately felt like we had just entered a different sphere of existence. It was like the world we knew did not exist there. Bhagwan's presence, his other worldliness, would so envelop the atmosphere. When we again walked out of the hall, we were confronted with the old world we knew all too well. Nowadays, we see many spiritual teachers opening schools, hospitals, and the like. All this philanthropy has a purpose, no doubt, but Bhagwan never asked us to do such things. He wanted us to do one thing only, that is to know who we are, to know the self. He believed this to be the panacea for all human suffering and the goal of life. But how many of us are adequately earnest to seek the self alone? We are continually diverted and distracted by what we call helping the world. Where is the world? And who are we? This is what we should be looking into. In January of 1938, after staying with the Maharishi for 1 year, I returned to my village. I was planning to go again to the ashram after a couple of months, but before returning, I decided to make a trip to North India. After hearing very favorable remarks about Sri Krishna Prem from Dilip Kumar Roy in Aurobindo Ashram, I had a desire to visit him at his ashram in the Himalayas. He lived about 18 miles from Almora. I left my village and traveled by train to Delhi. From there, I immediately boarded another train for Bareilly, Uttar Pradesh, where I changed to another train that took me north to Kathagodam. I was advised to get down at Haldwani, one stop before Kathagodam, and board a bus for Almora. Following this advice, I arrived at Almora in the evening and spent the night in a dharmashala. About 8:30 a.m., I hired a coolie to carry my luggage and then began the 18-mile trip through the forest and hills to Sri Krishna Prem's ashram in Mutola. We covered about 2 miles every hour and reached the ashram by 4:30 p.m. Approaching the ashram, I could see from a distance his tall figure standing outside. I had not written him prior to this visit, nor did he have any idea who I was or where I was coming from. Nevertheless, he greeted me warmly, asked me to take my things to an adjacent guest room, and then returned to him for refreshments. Krishna Prem was living there with his guru. Yashodamma. When Swami Vivekananda was still an unknown wandering monk, he chose the young daughter of a gracious host at Ghazipur for symbolic worship in Kumari Puja, as observed in Bengal. That same little Brahmin girl would one day become Yashodamma, the guru of Krishna Prem. Krishna Prem's pre-sannyasa name was Reynold Nixon. He was a brilliant graduate of Cambridge who came to India drawn by a spiritual thirst unquenched in England. He taught English literature at the universities of Lucknow and Benares before renouncing and becoming a Vaishnava monk. Krishna Prem spoke fluent Hindi and Bengali, and he was also a serious student of Sanskrit and Pali. Their ashram building had a shrine room, kitchen, library, and a couple of other rooms on the ground floor. One additional room was built upstairs. The land they bought was 3 miles in circumference. Krishna Prem told me that the broker who arranged the purchase deceived them on some details. They, however, decided to make the best of it and appeared to be quite settled when I made this visit in May of 1938. To me, the ashram was like an isolated oasis, surrounded by trees and hills, and far removed from the scorching summer heat I had just experienced in the plains. I had brought with me 2 supportive fruits from my village garden, which I offered to them. They had never seen this variety of fruit and became extremely interested to know all about it. After eating the fruit, they saved its black seeds with the intention of planting them in the garden. I saw that they were growing many fruits and vegetables, and I was told had even tried the hands at starting a tea garden. But because of the excess of humidity in those hills, it failed. When Krishna Prem and Yashodamma came to know that I had spent 5 years in Aurobindo Ashram, 1 year in Sri Ramana Ashramam, they became keen to hear all about Bhagavan and Aurobindo. I had planned on staying with them for only 3 days, but when I started telling them stories about Bhagavan and Sri Ramana Ashramam, they decided I should stay a month. So intrigued were they on hearing about the Maharishi. I was not prepared to make a longer stay and so left them as scheduled. During this short visit, I was able to observe that they were living an exemplary life of one-pointed devotion and intense spiritual practice. Apparently, the weather of this mountain retreat favored Yashodamma's health, whereas the weather near the sea favored her husband's. Thus, for health reasons, they lived separately. Yashodamma's daughter was also then living at the ashram, and Yashodamma had so much faith and trust in Krishna Prem, he had given her over to his care. He, on his part, looked after her like his own ward. When Krishna Prem asked Yashodamma to initiate him and make him her disciple, she said, "Yes, I will, but there is one condition, that is, that you never complain about your spiritual progress." He consented and till his end was fully satisfied with the stature and grace of his guru. Many years after this visit, I received a letter from him wherein he wrote that we were both blessed, me because I had Bhagavan as my guru and he because he had Yashodamma. I stuck to my plan and left the ashram after the 3rd day, returned to Almora, and then travelled to Dehradun. From there, I boarded a bus for Rajpur, which is just 7 miles south of Missouri. A 1 mile walk up the hill from Rajpur was the ashram of Dr. K.D. Sastri. In 1931, after leaving my studies in Benares, I visited this ashram. Even when I had come here 7 years earlier, its founder was already deceased and his American wife was managing the institution. It was founded for the purpose of teaching young people spiritual traditions, Indian history, and other cultural subjects. When I first went there in 1931, T.L. Vaswani was a resident teacher. He was then a popular author of many respected books, an acclaimed public speaker, and an esteemed spiritual personality in his own right. Prior to teaching in this ashram, he was the chancellor of a college, a job he resigned for the purpose of becoming a sadhu, a title which later became a prefix to his name, Sadhu Vaswani. He was not teaching in this ashram when I came there this second time. Soon after arriving at Dr. K.D. Sastri's ashram, someone asked me if I had met the Bengali mystic saint who lived just 4 miles south of there. I had not, and so was encouraged to again take the return bus and get down at Chainpur, which was just halfway between this ashram and Dehradun. Alighting there, I inquired and soon found the house of the saint. I was met at the entrance and escorted to a room where I was asked to enter and take a seat on the floor. Before me sat a remarkable looking woman clad in a white sari, sitting on a white sheet that was spread over a thin mattress laid on the floor. Her spiritual charm and the cool breeze of peace and harmony that she radiated had an extraordinary effect on me. I almost felt as if I was sitting before the Maharishi himself, and in many ways similar to the Maharishi, glowing with warmth and illumination, sat a rare spiritual personality of the 20th century, Anandamayi Ma. She was then 42 years old. In an endearing manner, she made kind inquiries about matters concerning my life. As we were talking, the room slowly filled up with visitors. I told her that I had just come from Krishna Prem's ashram. After hearing that, she said that Krishna Prem and Yashodhamma had created an Uttar North Vrindavan in Almora. When I looked around the room again, I saw many devotees had gathered. Some were meditating, some were talking quietly among themselves, and others began questioning Anandamayi Ma and certain matters. Everything seemed to be going on spontaneously in a natural manner. There appeared to be no enforced code of behavior in Anandamayi Ma's presence, which immediately reminded me of the old hall at Sri Ramanashramam. At about noon, the saint stood up and walked out of the room. A few of the devotees followed her, and I decided to do likewise. She walked to a doorway of another room and stood there looking in. I also looked into that room and saw a bearded, middle-aged man lying on the floor, writhing in pain. I was surprised to have recognized this man from an incident that occurred 2 days earlier while I was traveling to Rajpur. When I was in Dehradun and boarded the bus for Rajpur, this same bearded man had entered the bus and sat next to me. The bus was nearly full, and although it was the scheduled departure time, the bus driver and ticket collector had not yet made their appearance. Consequently, most of the passengers began to show signs of impatience, especially this bearded gentleman seated beside me. He went to the point of getting off the bus and shouting out loud for the driver, imagining that he was in some building nearby neglecting his duties. I later discovered that this might have been true, probably for financial reasons dictated by the bus owner. The bus personnel were notorious for not showing up till the bus was filled to capacity, regardless of the scheduled departure time. Eventually, the driver appeared. The passengers grumbled a bit, and we left Dereden. Standing in the doorway, seeing this same bearded man, terribly ill, I was told that he was the husband of Anandamayi Ma. How Anandamayi Ma happened to marry him, the relationship they had together, and how they came to move from Dhaka to this place makes quite an interesting story. I was later informed that on the day of my first visit to Anandamayi Ma, her husband was ill with smallpox. Knowing this, Anandamayi Ma asked her mother and a resident disciple known as D.D. to leave the house and live elsewhere. Of course, they objected. She then told them if they did not leave, she would. Ultimately, they were persuaded to leave, and Anandamayi Ma was left alone to attend to the needs of her sick husband. Her husband was a good man, loved by all of Ma's followers. He was even looked upon as a father figure in the ashram, and although he was well served by his wife during this illness, he eventually succumbed to the disease. Perhaps she had anticipated this and wanted to be alone with him during his last days. Just before dying, he joined his palms together in salutation and said to his wife, "You are my mother." There is little doubt that Anandamayi did more than attend to just his physical needs during those last days. The time she spent alone with him certainly must have brought him far along on his spiritual journey. In the afternoon, I returned to Dr. K.D. Sastri's ashram. A younger American sister of K.D. Sastri's widow was also in the ashram at this time. She was interested in studying music and was taking lessons in Lucknow. She was also quite interested in coming to Thiruvannamalai to meet Bhagavan. Before leaving there, I told her to write to me and come to Ramanashramam when I was present in the ashram. She somehow came when I wasn't present, stayed in the Morvi guest house, and was relieved of over 400 rupees by a thief. She had no idea of what security precautions to take. In due time, she left India and returned to America. After a 2 or 3 day visit to the Rajpur ashram, I left for Vrindavan. I had no special desire to visit Vrindavan at that time, but Krishna Prem made me promise that I would stop there while returning south. Yashoda Ma's guru, a sannyasi, lived there, and they wanted me to meet him. Also, they wanted me to visit a few of Krishna Prem's disciples who lived in a house they owned in Vrindavan. When I arrived, I immediately went and visited the sannyasi and disciples and was able to board a departing train the very same day. Although I was then feeling eager to return to Ramanashramam, I decided I would break my journey once more before reaching Thiruvannamalai. To be continued.